Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents China Hand by Harry Homewood, narrated by Joe Barrett. Prologue. The warm August sun beat down on the port city of Qingdao. On a street not far from the waterfront, storekeepers sat in the doorways of their small shops, enjoying the cool breeze that swept inland from the harbor. There was a small stir among the shopkeepers as a food vendor appeared at the end of the street. As the vendor slowly pushed his cart up the street, he was followed by a small crowd of the city's homeless poor, their eyes intent on the steaming pots of rice and vegetables. The vendor suddenly veered to one side as his sharp ears picked up a "Hogta, Hogta," echoing down the street. He pushed his cart up against the side of a building and squatted beside it, his eyes wary. The beggars following him disappeared into alleys or huddled in doorways, their eyes turned away from the street. A line of chanting prisoners, their shaven heads gleaming in the sun, came up the street. The prisoners were in a column of 20 pairs of men, each man's right ankle tied with a rope to his partner's left ankle. Each of the prisoners carried a pick or shovel. On each side of the column, two soldiers armed with rifles kept pace. An officer, a captain in General Chiang Kai-shek's army of the Kuomintang, rode behind the column in a rickshaw. He nodded to the merchants sitting in front of their stores as he passed. They inclined their heads gravely in return. The column turned a corner at the end of the street and marched to a large field, a scant half-mile from the waterfront. The captain kicked his rickshaw puller in the back, and the man quickened his pace and gained position at the head of the column. The officer waved a languid hand at one of the soldiers, a weather-beaten sergeant. The sergeant barked an order, and the other three soldiers freed the prisoners of their ankle ropes. The sergeant marked a spot in the grass with his foot, and the prisoners lined up and began to dig a long ditch 3 feet wide and 4 feet deep. The officer watched them from his rickshaw, nodding his head in approval at their energy. The digging finished, the prisoners put their picks and shovels in a neat pile. Half of the prisoners moved to one side. At a word from the sergeant, the other half removed their cotton trousers and singlets and folded them neatly and put them beside the picks and shovels. The 20 men, clad only in their ragged cotton undershorts, lined up along the ditch. The captain barked an order, and the 20 men knelt along the edge of the ditch, their eyes staring at a small crowd of spectators who had assembled on the edge of the field. The captain got out of the rickshaw with a grunt and handed a canvas bag to his sergeant. He drew a Mauser pistol from the wooden holster he wore in his belt and cocked it. The captain walked up behind the first prisoner in line and took position, his right arm extended at full length out from his body. He carefully placed the muzzle of the pistol at the back of the man's head. He pulled the trigger, and the prisoner's body jerked and then slumped and fell forward into the ditch. The captain walked to the next man and took position. Farther down the line, a 17-year-old boy turned his head enough to see the face of the second prisoner disappear in a bloody spray and the body fall forward. He turned his head to the front and stared at the spectators, and then he closed his eyes and waited. When the pistol's magazine was empty, the captain removed it from the pistol's butt and handed it to the sergeant, who took a fresh magazine out of the sack and gave it to his captain. The last man in the line along the ditch, shivering with fear, jerked his head as the pistol thundered and his body sprawled half in, half out of the ditch. The captain kicked the man's legs down into the ditch and nodded his head at the remaining prisoners. They picked up shovels and began to fill in the communal grave. Next week, they would be the ones to kneel down and be executed while yet another group of felons watched. When the grave was filled and the earth smoothed, the soldiers tied the prisoners to each other, and they marched back into the city, carrying the picks and shovels and the clothing of the dead. The column stopped at a word from the captain on the street of shopkeepers. The captain motioned to the food vendor, still huddled beside his cart. The vendor brought him a bowl of rice and a pair of chopsticks. The captain ate in greedy gulps and belched loudly. He made a vague gesture toward his tunic pocket, and the vendor shook his head. "It is honor enough, sir, that you eat my humble food," the vendor said. The captain nodded. "Those beggars who follow you, do any of them try to steal from you?" "No, sir, they are only poor, not thieves. his eyes turned toward the column of prisoners. "We all know what happens to thieves, honored captain."
"You are ordered by me to report any thieves,"
the captain said in a loud voice that could be heard up and down the street. "General Chiang Kai-shek has issued strict orders. All thievery must be stopped." He grinned, his eyes almost disappearing in his fat cheeks.
"I am eliminating thieves. When they are all gone, then there can be no more thievery, and I will have obeyed my general's orders. Do you agree, you miserable dog's turd?"
"How could one as humble as I find fault with your logic, sir?" the food vendor answered. The officer put the vendor's bowl and chopsticks into the canvas bag between his feet. He snapped out an order, and the column moved down the street. The vendor stood watching, and as the column disappeared around a street corner, he took a deep breath and spat as far as he could down the street. He went back to his cart and stirred the charcoal fire to a brisk blaze and began his slow passage down the street. From the alleys and doorways, the beggars reappeared and formed up behind him, hoping that one of the merchants would leave a little of the vendor's food in the bottom of their bowl for them. One shopkeeper, a fat man with deep laughter wrinkles around his eyes, looked at the beggars trailing behind the food vendor and sighed. He held out two bowls to the vendor, who filled them with rice and vegetables. The shopkeeper handed one bowl to a couple, a man and a woman, whose rags barely covered their scrawny bodies. The man bowed and handed the bowl to his wife. She scooped the food into her mouth with her fingers. When she had almost half-emptied the bowl, she handed it to her husband. The beggar ate slowly and carefully, wiped the inside of the bowl with a finger, and sucked the finger. He handed the bowl back to the shopkeeper.
"When your time comes to leave this life, merciful one, may you be fat and happy, and surrounded by many grandchildren."
The shopkeeper nodded. Chapter 1 The USS Chaumont, one of the U.S. Navy's two transport ships, swung at anchor in Manila Harbor. On the ship's upper deck, the draft, 200 enlisted men and officers, destined for a minimum of 2 years' duty in the Asiatic fleet, milled about as they waited for the announcement of debarkation for those assigned to duty at the Cavite Navy Yard, the floating dry dock at Olongapo, or the Navy ships stationed in Manila. Robert Burns McPherson, seaman second class, a tall, slender boy man 5 months short of his 18th birthday, stood at the ship's rail. In the distance, he could see the white glare of the buildings in the city of Manila. He glanced upward as thunder rumbled. It was hot, and the torrential summer rains fell late every afternoon and into the night. John White, gunner's mate second class, who had been in some of the working parties with McPherson on the trip over from the United States, moved alongside him at the ship's rail. "You getting off here in Manila?" the gunner's mate asked. McPherson shook his head. "No, I'm going to a submarine, the S-37. The transfer orders on the bulletin board said she's in Shanghai, wherever that is from here. North, biggest port in China. Figure about 4 or 5 days to get there once we get underway. Slow as this old tub travels. I'm getting off there myself. Going to a river gunboat, the Panay. Hell of a lot better duty than a submarine." "How's that?" McPherson asked. "Independent duty. I'll be the only gunner's mate aboard. My own boss. Fella I knew back in the States, he'd done duty on the river gunboats. He said all they do is ride shotgun for the Standard Oil barges. Go up and down the Yangtze River, protecting the oil barges. He said there was lots of good liberty ports upriver. The chow in the gunboats is supposed to be the best in the Navy. Anything would be better than the way this damn ship feeds. Mess cook dumped a spoon of jam on top of the 2 pieces of bread I was holding in my hand this morning, and the damn jam ran right through the bread and filled up my hand. Damn supply officer is watering the jam like he waters the coffee and the stew. I hope they catch the bastard and send him to Portsmouth, where the Marines will run his ass ragged." He looked at McPherson. "They passed the word a while ago that payday will be held for the people leaving in Shanghai after the Manila draft leaves the ship. You got much money on the books?"
"I guess so," McPherson said. "I don't smoke, and I had lots of toothpaste and stuff when I came aboard, so I haven't drawn any money since before we left the States. There's a nice little poker game in the bosun's locker up forward," the gunner's mate said. "The game is run by the chief master at arms. He only cuts the pot a buck each deal, which is a hell of a lot friendlier than some games I've seen. Safe, too. Ain't nobody gonna raid a poker game run by the boss policeman on the ship. Shanghai's supposed to be a hell of a liberty port. Lots of good places to eat, lots of women, all kinds of nationalities from what I heard. Might as well come up after chow and double your money, so you can make a real liberty in Shanghai before you get transferred to that sardine can they call a submarine. I'll think about that, and thanks, McPherson said. The gunner's mate slapped him on the back and moved off down the deck, and began to talk to another young sailor. McPherson had no intention of playing poker. His father had made it very plain to him. Playing cards for money was a skilled trade. Unless he was willing to be poor for a long time while he learned the trade, it would be wise to not play cards with anyone for money. He heard footsteps on the steel deck, and turned as a tall, gangly sailor with a red stripe around the left shoulder seam of his white jumper walked up to him. The red stripe denoted the wearer as a fireman, a non-rated man assigned to work in a ship's engine rooms. Seamen wore a blue stripe around the right shoulder seam of their white jumpers.
"Guy over there said your name is McPherson. That right?"
McPherson nodded. The other man stuck out his hand.
"I'm Billy Simpson. Billy, not William or Bill or any other damn name. Just Billy, the way my old man named me. He didn't give me no middle initial, but the Navy did. N for no middle initial. Ain't that a crock? I'm going to the S-37. We're the only two going there, so I thought we should get acquainted with each other."
He thrust out his hand again, arching his narrow chest as he did so. McPherson shook hands with him. "How long have you been in the Navy?" McPherson asked.
11 months, Simpson said. "Got out of boot camp and went to a tin can. That's a destroyer. Got me a case of jaundice, and that sent me to the hospital in San Diego."
He tipped his white hat down over his forehead until the brim rested on his eyebrows.
"Made me a little run one evening on a Navy nurse, a lieutenant," he drawled. "She didn't like the idea of an enlisted man patting her on the ass. Not that she had such a great ass, come to think of it. She put me on report, and they threw me in a brig for a week. They hauled me up in front of captain's mast and said I was a troublemaker. And since I was over the jaundice, they were going to send me where all the troublemakers get sent, to the Asiatic fleet. What did you do to screw up?"
"Nothing that I know of," McPherson said. "I got out of boot camp, and they sent me to radio operator school in Diego. When I passed the graduation exams, you can take those whenever you think you can pass them, they sent me to Goat Island in San Francisco to wait for the Chaumont." He paused. "I haven't seen you around anywhere. Where have you been? Down in the engine rooms?"
"Down in the damned bilges is where I've been," Simpson answered. "The ship's company firemen on this here ship don't know what their bilges look like. Soon as they get a draft aboard, they put all the draft engineers down in the bilges and keep them there."
McPherson grinned. "I've been learning a trade on the way over from the States, chipping rust and wire brushing and painting, every day the whole trip.
At least you up in the sunshine and fresh air, not down in the damned bilges.
And in the rain, don't forget that. The Navy's the only place in the world where they paint while it's raining," McPherson said. "You were lucky to be down in the bilges. If you could get in trouble with a Navy nurse in the hospital, you'd have been short-shafted every Friday morning if you were working up here on deck."
Simpson frowned. "Why would I be in trouble? What's short-shafting?"
"I spent most of the trip working up here on the boat deck where we are now. Over there by that air vent pipe, they stretched a piece of rope from one side of the boat deck to the other. We worked after the rope. Forward of the rope was where the wives and daughters of officers in the draft took their sunbaths in bathing suits. That was a restricted area. We weren't supposed to even look at the women and the daughters. If one of the officers' wives caught you looking at them, she'd call the master-at-arms and put you on report. On Friday morning, you'd be short-shafted." He stopped and looked at Simpson. "You people in the engine rooms hold field day every Friday, clean and polish everything in sight, get ready for inspection Saturday morning?" Simpson nodded. "Okay, topside on Friday morning, the bosun mates wet down the wooden decks with saltwater hoses, and then they spread sand all over the wet deck. They give you a holy stone. That's a real heavy, real rough sort of a brick with a little shallow hole gouged in the top of the brick. They give you a long pole, like a broomstick, only a lot thicker and heavier. You put the end of the pole in the hole on top of the holy stone and push it back and forth across the wet, sandy deck. It's hard work. You have to bear down real hard to keep the end of the pole in the holy stone and move it. But it scrubs the wooden deck clean as anything. If you're on report, they give you a pole that's only about 2 feet long. That's short-shafting. It looked to me like it was awful hard work to bend over and still push the holy stone. The officer's wife or daughter who had put you on report would always be there to make sure the guy they'd put on report got short-shafted.
"Won't be any damned women aboard our submarine," Simpson said. "Don't see how any submarine can have bilges, either. Too small a ship. You know what one of the ship's company machinist's mate told me? He said that once you learned all about a submarine, inside and out, and passed a test, I think he called it some name like qualifying, you got extra pay. He said $25 a month extra."
McPherson's eyes widened. "That much? I get $36 a month as a seaman second. That would almost double my pay."
The S-37 swung on a mooring cable, shackled to a buoy, in the center reach of the Yangtze River. On either side of the river, the mudflats steamed in the summer heat. Upstream, the sun glinted on the buildings of the International Settlement, the walled and guarded enclave maintained by foreign nations within the city of Shanghai. The noon meal was over, and most of the submarine's crew not ashore on Liberty had gathered topside. Leclerc, Frenchy, Nadeau, a man so darkly handsome that veteran bar girls gasped when he smiled at them, sat in the gunpointer seat of the big 4-inch 50-caliber deck gun that dominated the small foredeck of the S-37.
"We getting any new bodies from the Chaumont draft, Gunner?" Nadeau asked.
"Two."
Alvin Grady Jones, Gunner's mate first class, the chief of the boat, answered.
"One snipe for Mike and a seaman deuce. I sure hope my new boy ain't one of them fat stateside types,"
Mike DeLucia, the machinist mate in charge of the S-37's engine room, said.
"If he's one of them, we're going to have to trim him down so he can crawl down in the bilges."
Andy Roberts, radio man second class, squinted his pale gray eyes at Gunner Jones. "Personnel yeoman on the tender told me the seaman deuce we're getting graduated from radio operator school in Diego. Damn it, Gunner, I'm getting sick of standing far on and far off watches every time we get underway. If this new guy can stand a radio watch, I need him."
"He's a seaman deuce is what he is, Sparky," Gunner Jones said. "We haven't had a deck ape since that goofball we did have got himself the syphilis in the spine and had to be sent back to the States to die. The torpedo gang's been doubling up and doing the topside work. So the new guy works topside for me and stands wheel watches underway. You can have him when I ain't got anything for him to do or he isn't on watch."
"That day will never come if I know you," the radio man said.
"You there, aboard the 37 boat." The voice was sharp, nasal, and came from a motor launch moving past the S-37.
An officer dressed in a starched, gleaming white uniform was standing up at the motor launch and pointing.
"Those men sitting on the ship's rail! Ship's rails are not to be sat upon!"
The submarine sailors, who had been resting their buttocks against the battered pipe rail around the submarine's deck, stood erect.
"Now who in the hell is that worry wart?" Mike DeLucia grumbled. "That's the J.G. Lieutenant the 40-boat got from some tin can when we were down in a longer boat in dry dock," Frenchy Nadeau said. "Guy I know on a 40-boat says he's so full of the old Navy line that he leaves a brown stain behind him when he walks. He'll be eating that brown stain for breakfast when Froggy Robinson gets through with him," Gunner Jones said. "Now there's a chief of the boat you clowns should have. Old Froggy, he'd have your asses in high gear from reveille until lights out. He's a bear, that old Froggy. He eats young lieutenants for breakfast. He ain't easy going like I am."
"Your ass is sucking wind, Gunner," Nadeau said. "Motor launch, standing this way. Two dudes in undress whites in her. Might be our new people."
A sailor standing in the bow of the 40-foot motor launch snagged a rail stanchion on the S-37 with a boat hook, and the launch swung in and bumped gently against the swell of the submarine's ballast tanks. The two sailors in white uniforms moved toward the side of the launch and reached upward for the lower railing around the submarine's deck.
"Pick up your sea bags and hammocks and heave them on board," Gunner Jones roared. "What the hell do you think this is, some hotel with nigger porters to carry your bags? Sling your gear up on deck and then come aboard."
The two sailors scrambled toward the bow of the launch and struggled with their hammocks and sea bags. In accordance with the tradition that reached back to the days of wooden ships and iron men, sailors traveled with all their clothing and personal possessions packed neatly into a 4-foot-long stout canvas sea bag. A canvas hammock with a thin mattress, two blankets, and a small pillow made up the rest of the sailor's gear.
When a sailor was transferred from one ship or duty station to another, he emptied his locker and carefully folded and rolled each article of his clothing into a tight little sausage that was tied in a strictly prescribed manner with two pieces of white cord. The clothing and whatever else he owned was then packed in the sea bag. Once that was done to his satisfaction, he stretched his hammock out on deck and placed his mattress, blankets, and pillow on the hammock. Then, usually with the assistance of shipmates, he rolled the hammock into a long, tight roll, using a half-inch manila line to secure the rolled hammock. 7 marlin hitches and a clove hitch completed the job. The sea bag was positioned lengthwise on the hammock, and the two ends of the hammock drawn up and over the sea bag. The whole bundle was then firmly lashed together with the lines used to suspend the hammock. The resulting package was awkward to handle and could weigh close to 100 pounds. Frenchy Nadeau watched with an amused smile as the two young sailors struggled to lift their sea bags and hammocks up on a forward thwart of the motor launch. He shook his head and jumped down into the motor launch. "Let a submarine sailor show you how this is done," he said, his white teeth gleaming in a smile under his trimmed black mustache. With two heaves of his powerful arms and shoulders, he threw the two sea bags and hammocks up on the submarine's deck. He turned to the two young sailors. "Would you girls like a hand up, or can you make it all by yourselves?" He leaped upward off the thwart, caught the submarine's deck railing, and vaulted over it, landing lightly on the deck. McPherson waited until the motor launch swung back against the submarine's hull. He grabbed the lower railing and scrambled aboard on his hands and knees. Simpson followed him. Gunner Jones held out his hand. "Orders," he growled. The two men handed over sealed envelopes they had carried in the waistbands of their trousers. Gunner Jones looked at the envelopes and jerked a thumb at Simpson. "This one's your snipe, Mike. Name of Billy. No middle initial. Billy Simpson. Fireman Third. Simpson, that dude with the curly black hair is Mike DeLucia. He runs the engine room on this ship. You work for him." "Robert Burns McPherson," Gunner Jones read from the other envelope. "Now that's a hell of a lot of name for a seaman deuce as skinny as you are. You work for me. I'm Gunner Jones, chief of the boat. First thing both of you people do is get your gear below. The below-decks watch will show you your lockers. Stow your gear in your lockers. I don't have any bunks empty, so roll and lash your mattresses and stow them outboard of the reload torpedoes in the torpedo room. Below-decks watch will show you where. Change into dungarees and get back topside. Bring your hammocks and sea bags and the whites you're wearing with you. I want your uniforms and sea bags and hammocks scrubbed clean. Now, when the sea bags and hammocks are dry, we'll stow them somewhere until we get alongside the tender. Then you'll stow them in the ship's locker aboard the tender. Got all that?" "What do we use to scrub with?" Simpson's voice was quavery. "Your damned toothbrush, if I say so," Jones growled. "You'll find 2 buckets, scrub brushes, and saltwater soap in the afterport corner of the torpedo room. Those will be your personal buckets, and I want them shined until you can see to shave in them. If either one of you live long enough to get old enough to shave..." "Trade you my snipe for your deck ape," DeLucia said to Jones after the two young sailors had gone below decks. "At least your guy had the good sense to keep his mouth closed." "Up to you to teach the kid some manners," Jones said. "Your kid will split mess cooking with mine, day on and day off. He can stand watches underway or do whatever else you need him for when he isn't mess cooking." "When we get him underway, Gunner?" Nadeau asked. 0800 tomorrow, Jones answered. Nadeau rolled his brown eyes. "Ah, Qingdao, the Riviera of the Orient, whatever the hell that means," Nadeau said. "I wonder if Olga still works in Pop Darling's cafe." Jones' deeply tanned face split in a grin. "Olga? You running after white Russians, Frenchy? I thought you were in love with that Eurasian broad who runs the fantan game near the dock." "I do love her," Frenchy said. "Love her, love her money like crazy. But that Olga, she's got muscles up inside her snatch that can bow your legs, trim your toenails, and make you howl like a wolf all at the same time. Man owes it to himself to know about things like that." McPherson was on deck early the next morning, mindful of Gunner Jones' command to stay the hell out of the way and watch everything that went on. The submarine's 2 Nalseco diesels rumbled into life, and Lieutenant J.G. Frank M. Farrell, a tall, lean man with a dark, sardonic face, delicately maneuvered the sharp bow of the S-37 alongside the mooring buoy. Frenchy Netto leaped gracefully onto the slanting surface of the buoy, a long steel marlin spike in one hand. He used the marlin spike to loosen the pin in a shackle that secured the mooring cable to the buoy. He let the cable drop free and pocketed the shackle as the submarine backed away from the buoy, while the torpedo men on deck pulled in the cable and stowed it in a deck locker. As the submarine nosed back to the buoy, Netto braced himself against the sloping top of the buoy and leaped back aboard.
"Next time we come into this port," Jones said to McPherson, "what the Frenchman did will be your job, so don't forget nothing you saw. Savvy?"
McPherson turned in early that night, exhausted by his first day of mess cooking under the grumbling tyranny of Skinny Whitmore, the ship's cook. He was fast asleep, lost in a dream of his home in a suburb outside of Chicago, when someone tugged at his hair. A voice, pitched low, said in his ear, "You got 4 to 8 wheel watch. You got 15 minutes to piss and get coffee. Move it, sailor." The sky was dark as he climbed awkwardly out of the bridge hatch into the S-37's tiny bridge space. He could see the dark smudge of Nadeau's mustache in the dim light of the compass's repeater. "We're steering course 320, Netto said, his voice barely audible in the quiet of the bridge. "You have a standard wheel watch, kid?" "No," McPherson said in a whisper. "Easy as beating your meat. Easier. Stand here. Give me your left hand. This brass handle under your hand. Push it left, the ship's bow goes left. Push it the other way, it goes right. That black line down the glass over the compass card, that's the lubber's line. The center line of the ship, bow to stern. You keep that line on the course you're steering. The quartermaster will give you a hand if you screw up. His name is Smoky Joe Rivers. Got it? 320. Take over." McPherson stared at the compass card, half paralyzed with fright and indecision. He saw the figures on the compass drifting slowly past the black line. He pushed the handle in his left hand hard to one side, and the figures moved much more rapidly. He pushed harder. A hand suddenly clamped over his on the steering handle.
"Take it easy, you stupid asshole," Rivers hissed into his ear. "Let me have her. Longer you hold that handle over, the more rudder you got, and the faster the bow swings. Wait until I bring her back on course, and then keep your hand on mine and see how it's done. Damn Frenchy, all he thinks about is storing up enough sleep before we make port so he can go ashore and screw some broad all through a 48-hour weekend. Wouldn't have hurt him none to stayed up here and given you a half hour of help. Bastard."
As dawn broke, McPherson was handling the helm alone. He had concentrated so hard on doing the job and doing it right that he hadn't noticed the occasional comings and goings in the tiny bridge space. Now he stood, feet apart, braced, his left hand on the steering handle. His right hand rested lightly on the metal rim of the compass repeater, his eyes moving from the compass card and the lubber's line to the ship's bow, reading the long swells of the yellow sea. He felt strangely at ease. He sensed, felt, through his feet and legs, the movement of the ship as it rose to a swell. With minuscule movements of the ship's rudder, he met the force of a sea against the bow of the ship to keep an unwavering course. Behind the submarine, a long white wake stretched out in a straight line. Somewhere deep in the genetic mystery of Robert Burns McPherson, landlubber, a seaman's gene had come to life. He half smiled as the submarine's bow splintered a swell and threw a pearly spray of water back over the white wooden slats of the deck. "You make a good wake, sailor." The voice, unmistakably feminine in timbre and tone, came from behind and above McPherson. He half turned, and his mouth gaped open in surprise as he saw a woman dressed in faded dungarees and a dungaree shirt standing in the periscope shears. She held a coffee cup in her hand. Smoky Joe Rivers etched up next to McPherson.
"Captain's wife," he whispered. "She rides with us when we go north in the spring and south in the fall. She comes up here at daybreak every morning. Watches the wake to make sure we do our job. Don't use no bad language when she's around."
McPherson nodded and stared straight ahead, concentrating on steering an absolutely straight course. He felt someone touch his shoulder.
"Morning, McPherson," Lieutenant Farrow said. "I want to see you in the wardroom after breakfast is secured and you're off watch. The chief of the boat will give you the word when I'm ready."
"Your new man handles the ship very well, Frank," the woman said.
"So I heard you say when I was in the conning tower, Muriel," Farrow said.
Maybe we got ourselves a seaman in the draft.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?